Pompeo in Africa.
You can see increased investment. You can see it in ways that are important to liberate the people of this region, to liberate Angolan people. You can see that our investments are transparent, they're clean.
I'm Arun Vanagopal, and today on The Takeaway, we'll discuss the Trump White House's Prosper Africa plan and what American diplomacy means to the people in that region. Also, the Boy Scouts of America are looking to regroup after filing for bankruptcy.
It is about financial compensation, but for the survivors, it's about the truth coming out, and it's about the history of Boy Scouts, sexual abuse, and not protecting kids.
Plus, your takes on this.
As both an Eagle Scout and victim of abuse by one of my Scout leaders, I believe that this had to happen.
Plus, California apologizes for internment camps 80 years later. Let's get going. Today, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo wraps up his first visit to sub-Saharan Africa during his term. He's visited Senegal, Ethiopia, and Angola, and has spoken to business leaders about expanding trade on the continent. Secretary Pompeo is promoting the White House plan for the region called Prosper Africa, which shifts U.S. involvement away from aid and towards investment. In Senegal, Pompeo announced a number of projects, including a 100-mile highway.
Foreign Minister and I discussed how we can tighten our trade ties even further, including infrastructure investment, embracing free market policies that attract capital, private capital, ensuring consistent enforcement of the law, and doubling down on any corruption efforts are the surest way to grow prosperity in Nigeria and all across the region.
The Secretary of State has also been discussing military aid and security concerns as countries in West Africa are combating the presence of ISIS, Boko Haram, and Al-Qaeda. Yet, the Trump administration said it may withdraw troops from that region.
You can see that our investments are transparent, they're clean.
The administration has sent mixed signals about its priorities and interests in the continent more than once. Pompeo's visit comes shortly after the Trump administration expanded its travel ban to include four African countries: Eritrea, Nigeria, Sudan, and Tanzania. And it's only the second visit by a Secretary of State during this administration. In March of 2018, Rex Tillerson had to cut his trip to Africa short and was fired the day after returning. To talk about the U.S. role in Africa and how the Trump administration is doing against its goals there, I'm joined by Yinka Adegoke, Africa editor for Quartz. Thanks for being with us, Yinka.
Hi, Arun.
Also on the line, we have Jude Morf, visiting fellow at the Center for Global Development, who previously served as Liberia's Minister of Public Works. Welcome to The Takeaway.
Thanks. I'm glad to be a part of the conversation.
Yinka, we've got this big trip right now that the secretary is concluding right after the U.S. announces significant list of new countries on its travel ban. What is the message here from the U.S. to the countries in Africa?
Thanks, Arun. It's almost certainly a confused one. It's sending mixed signals to the countries that just are looking to the United States as a partner. If you are trying to work with countries, you can't at the same time be stopping their citizens from, you know, going through immigration processes or making it tougher for people to come into the country. At the very time when really America should be working closer with African countries, this is it's a great opportunity for the United States to really sort of take a lead in partnering with Africa right now. We are on the verge of the African Continental Free Trade Agreement, which is going to open up trade on the continent across the 54 countries. And, you know, the United States should be at the forefront, working to partner with the countries and moving forward.
Jude, anything to add there?
Well, I would just start by saying, you know, it is a good thing that a high-ranking U.S. government official is on the continent, because in international affairs, the importance of a relationship is evidenced in the number of high-level exchanges. So having the American Secretary of State on the continent is an indication to American businesses, to the U.S., American citizens wanting to engage with the continent, that the U.S. government sees the continent as important, and so the Secretary of State is visiting. I think that's a good thing. But I have to agree with Yinka that it seems as if the American policy toward the continent is on the one hand given, and then the other hand taken away. And one of the things I would add quickly is that the administration's budget submitted to Congress, Africa sees the greatest decline in terms of programs and support. I mean, countries like Malawi that has just done this great job with his democracy sees almost a 44% decline. Liberia, 55% decline. Guinea, 100% decline. So it's hard to imagine that you claim that this is an important part of the world, but you're reducing in terms of your support and engagement with it at the same time.
Judy, what can you tell us about some of the specific proposals from the Trump administration?
So I guess we'll go back to the U.S. Two-way trade between the continent and the United States has been declining for a while. In 2009, China surpassed the United States as the continent's largest trade partner. And so Prosper Africa, one of the things it tries to do is to double two-way trade between the United States and the continent. And this is a good thing because the continent needs as many partners as it can and doesn't want to be in an unbalanced relationship with a single partner. And so the idea here is to get more American investment on the continent, get more American businesses doing business on the continent. And that's one of the most concrete things they're trying to do. And one of the ways of doing that is to try to even the playing field for American companies on the continent. So American companies have complained that Chinese, Turkish, and even UK companies have the direct input of the government and support of the governments when they're on the continent. American companies didn't. So Prosper Africa creates these things called deal teams. It's a whole-of-government approach that provides support to U.S. businesses wanting to do business on the continent. So those are some of the concrete things that Prosper Africa seeks to accomplish.
Yinka, let's look at the state of China's investment in Africa. Over the last 15 years, it closed in on $2 trillion, according to the American Enterprise Institute. And according to CNBC, China-Africa trade in just 2017 was more than three times as much as U.S.-Africa trade. Does China simply take Africa a lot more seriously than the U.S. does?
Absolutely. Here's the key thing the way to think about the China-Africa and relationship and compared to the United States. You know, the Chinese, the huge strategic advantage that the Chinese have over the United States is not necessarily, you know, you often hear about loans and they're building all these, bridges and what have you.
Huge projects.
Huge construction. And they're doing all this great work, or, some of it's controversial. But the real advantage the Chinese have over the Americans is they're playing the long game. They're not just there on a kind of what's going to happen in the next 4-8 years, election cycle, whatever. They're thinking long term. They're literally looking at Africa and they're saying, we recognize this because this was us 30, 40 years ago. And we can make investments. Yes, we can make some money, yes, but we'll be together with these countries over the long term. And what you seem to see with the United States is it's just what can happen now? What can we get out of this right now? And really, Africa is a long-term, you think about these countries, is a long-term project. And it's not just a project. It's just the reality of the world. By the end of this century, 40% of all working people will be Africans. That's just the demographics of the way the world is changing. So this isn't somewhere, if you're thinking America first should actually be about how can we partner with these countries more comprehensively for the long term and not just for, let's cut our budgets here, let's move troops there. It's really thinking about integration, which is really what the Chinese have done.
Jude, when I think about the kinds of images that I grew up with in terms of the U.S. view of Africa, various parts of Africa, you think about the kind of comments that attributed to the president, certainly bordering on either patronizing or just certifiably racist. Are these attitudes really shaping official policy and business when it comes to U.S.-Africa trade?
We saw that over the last year, Africa, the tech industry in Africa is taking off, and about $1.3 billion went to African tech companies. A lot of that money is coming from the U.S. So that attitude is still prevalent, but there it's been punctured in a number of ways. And I just wanted to go back to what Yinka was saying, that there is something increasingly transactional about American policy. And it's this idea that, you know, we have to do it now. We have to be able to do it now. And one of the things that also comes up is supposedly African markets are way too small, too fragmented, and too balkanized and difficult to scale for American businesses seeking to do that. I'll just give you an example. China's total two-way trade with the continent over the last year was $208 billion. China's two-way trade with the whole world is $4 trillion. So you can see Africa is a very small piece of China's total trade and engagement with the world. But the first trip that a Chinese foreign minister makes every year is to Africa. So to Yinka's point about playing a long game, being strategic, and what we're seeing again and again is an insistence on tactical gains for American policy that is unmoored from a long-term strategic outcome. And so if this wasn't always this way. The U.S. is capable of long-term strategy, and the hope is that with Prosper Africa, we can begin to see that. But I also think, you know, I did an interview with Howard French, the former journalist and instructor now at Columbia University. And one of the things he said to change the perception of the U.S. in Africa, it has to be not just the U.S. government. The U.S. media has a role to play in terms of how the continent is increasingly perceived. He also commented on the fact that almost every American high-ranking official, whether it was President Obama or Secretary of State Clinton or Tillerson and now Pompeo, the minute they arrive on the continent, begin to talk about corruption. Corruption has to end. Corruption is sometimes it comes off as patronizing, right? And you don't get this from the UK. You don't get this from Turkey. You don't get this from the EU. You don't get this from China. And some of that has to change because you can't, on the one hand, be advocating an increase in two-way trade and at the same time, one, calling the place corrupt, two, reducing your security support. How do you make a place unsafe that you're encouraging American businesses to invest? So there's this two. It's like a struggle within the administration itself in terms of what its policy actually should be toward the continent. So in terms of perception, the government, yes, but I think in terms of U.S. media and how the continent is perceived has a significant role to play, too.
Yinka, I mean, Judah was talking about the fragmentation of the continent as being an obstacle, but Nigeria has the biggest economy in Africa, and here we go. The U.S., that is, imposing a travel ban. How much is this going to affect our business prospects?
Well, the way it might affect is it actually ties into to something that Judy brought up there about the like the tech, the rise Lagos in particular, but also Nairobi and some other cities have become huge tech hubs. And you can see that same sort of relationship with Silicon Valley where tech entrepreneurs are going to Silicon Valley and coming back, learning skills, coming back to the continent and building businesses, you lose some of that. Because I've already started to hear from some entrepreneurs who are in Silicon Valley saying, well, I'm not going to be able to renew my visa. It doesn't look like I can stay. I'll go to London. I'll go to some other city because they need the, you know, sort of technical skill.
Somewhere where you're more welcome.
Exactly. So we're going to see some of that happen. And it's just... And to be clear, some of these things are less about the actual specific policy and more about the signaling. Right, so investors start to think, well, maybe we shouldn't be there. People, you know, ICE operators start to be more aggressive, and people stop coming.
I've been speaking with Yinka Adegoke, Africa editor for Quartz, Jude Moore, visiting fellow at the Center for Global Development. Thanks to you both for being with us.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
You're listening to The Takeaway. I'm Arun Vanagopal. It's been almost 80 years since the U.S. government forced an estimated 120,000 Japanese Americans into internment camps.
When the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor, our west coast became a potential combat zone. Living in that zone were more than 100,000 persons of Japanese ancestry, two-thirds of them American citizens, one-third aliens. We knew that some among them were potentially dangerous. But no one knew what would happen among this concentrated population if Japanese forces should try to invade our shores. Military authorities therefore determined that all of them, citizens and aliens alike, would have to move.
After 3 long years, Japanese Americans were released from the camps and allowed to return to their homes and businesses, many of which had been looted and destroyed in their absence. The U.S. Commission on Wartime Relocation and Internment of Civilians illustrated the damages by asking, what if vandals broke into your home, sprayed graffiti, and ransacked your property simply because of race, gender, or religious affiliation? For years, the Japanese American community campaigned for a federal apology and compensation for the property and time they lost while in the camps. Finally, in 1988, Ronald Reagan signed the Civil Liberties Act, which formally apologized to Japanese Americans and granted $20,000 in restitution to each person interned during World War II.
The nation was then at war, struggling for its survival, and it's not for us today to pass judgment upon those who may have made mistakes while engaged in that great struggle. Yet we must recognize that the internment of Japanese Americans was just that, a mistake. For throughout the war, Japanese Americans in the tens of thousands remained utterly loyal to the United States.
Most of these internments happened in California, but up until now, the state of California has failed to issue its own formal apology. That's expected to change this week. On Thursday, one day after the 78th anniversary of the day FDR signed an executive order which authorized Japanese American incarceration, the state of California is issuing an apology through the passage of a bipartisan bill.
I introduced House Resolution 77 because, you know, I've been very concerned with the striking parallels that I and many other Japanese Americans have been seeing between what happened to Japanese Americans and what we see happening today. I wanted California to lead by example by acknowledging past mistakes, to learn the lessons of history so that we make sure that history doesn't repeat itself.
That was Al Muratsuchi, the assemblyman who introduced the resolution to California's state legislature. And while the measure is receiving widespread support, for some it was long overdue. For more on this, we're joined by Dr. Karen Korematsu, founder and executive director of the Fred T. Korematsu Institute. Her father, Fred Korematsu, resisted evacuation orders during World War II and was the plaintiff in the landmark Korematsu versus United States case in the Supreme Court. Also with us is Kristen Hayashi, director of collections management and access and a curator at the Japanese American National Museum. Her family was also incarcerated during World War II. Kristen and Karen, thank you both for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Dr. Korematsu, what does an apology from California mean to you today?
Well, it's very important that we remind everyone of the mistakes of the past because we keep repeating them. We hope that by bringing to light what this day represents, that the when the executive order 9066 was issued by Roosevelt, that it was not only a violation of due process of law, but it was also a violation of human rights. And we want people to remember, to honor, to educate, and also to advocate for everyone's civil rights, because, you know, it wasn't done in 1942, and we still have those challenges now.
Karen, we heard a little bit from that propaganda film earlier, but remind our listeners what the government's rationale was for incarcerating Japanese Americans.
Well, the rationale at the time, because it was led by General John DeWitt, who was the head of the Fourth Army in the San Francisco Presidio, was basically he was saying you couldn't separate the sheep from the goats, and you couldn't tell who was loyal and disloyal, which was absolutely, you know, not true. I mean, it was fabricated. It was lies. You know, at the time, you know, the government already had the reports, you know, from the FBI, J. Edgar Hoover, of all people, to say that they had already rounded up a couple thousand really Japanese nationals that they thought were in question. That also they had the report, the Ringel report from the U.S. Navy that stated that there was never any evidence of any spying or espionage. So this was all fabricated. But, you know, also the backstory was agriculture, that people had cried out because the Japanese had done so well in the agriculture up and down the West Coast. Their cry was, oh, they're taking away our jobs, which is a repeat of over our history, what we're even hearing now.
Kristen, your family, your relatives were incarcerated at these internment camps like Karen's. I'm curious, is your family still feeling the effects of that period to this day?
Well, I think that the evidence of intergenerational trauma is real. And I would say anecdotally that I feel those effects. I think my grandparents felt the need to prove that they were American in every way and to raise their children that way. And I think the consequence of that is that we lost the language and ties to our Japanese heritage and culture. And I think that there's a lot of healing that still is going on and a lot of seeking of information about where we come from and what the experience was of our relatives who were incarcerated during World War II.
Karen, did you have a similar experience in your family?
Yes. I mean, I'm much older, but it's still from generation to generation. That's very true. And actually, I never even learned about my father's Supreme Court case until I was in high school. And there was this code of silence not to talk about the incarceration because there had been so much trauma. You know, people had lost their dignity because they were basically accused of being spies, and it was their fault for the bombing of Pearl Harbor, just like what people experienced after 9/11, 2001.
Now, President Reagan, when he issued a federal apology, he said, as we heard earlier, it sounded like he was kind of hedging. On one hand, he acknowledged that this was a mistake, but he said it's not for us today to pass judgment upon those who may have made mistakes while engaged in that great struggle. How did that come off to you, Karen?
Well, at least what we had was an apology, an official apology from the president on behalf of all citizens, and that's what he said. We knew that it was a start of what we had to continue as far as education, down the road. But that was, that's still kind of the feeling, now. That's why this assembly bill that Almer Suchi and others is so important, because we need to remind people that we have not learned our lessons of history.
Kristen, it was the federal government who authorized the internment, but California state government also implemented policies targeting them. Could you remind us what exactly the state government did?
Sure. Well, the incarceration was just one event of a long history of discrimination towards Japanese immigrants and their descendants. The California legislature passed an alien land law in 1913, which prevented aliens ineligible from citizenship, so Japanese immigrants, from purchasing land. And that legislation became more stringent in the 1920s, to the point where, in some cases, it was difficult to lease land. And this was all with the intent of hindering social mobility of Japanese immigrants and their descendants. There were racial housing covenants as well that prevented Japanese from purchasing homes, in areas that they desired. And that was, again, just this long history of de jure and de facto discrimination.
Karen, right now we are going through a period of a broadening conversation about reparations and who deserves to receive reparations. Japanese Americans who were victims of the internment did receive $20,000 each. Where do you think the conversation should be going now in terms of reparations for other groups who've been on the receiving end of racism and bigotry on the part of the government?
One of the points that I make with the redress and the reparations is that you had to be living at the time that the Civil Liberties Act was signed in 1988 in order to receive the reparations. And if you even died the day before, then you were basically out of luck. So people, like my grandparents who had been, imprisoned
The families did not receive any type of reparations, but the reparations wasn't the important point that was significant to them. It was the apology, the official apology. But now I think this is we need to address for our other communities, especially our African American community. Point about an apology, about reparations, and how that will work. They need to create a commission to do that kind of report and research of how this would work, because it's going to be much more complicated. At the time, President Carter had issued the War Relocation Authority Commission to do just that, to research how the Japanese Americans had been treated during that time. So it's going to take be a long road, but it is something that we need to pursue, because if we don't address the racial prejudice in this country, then we're never going to be able to achieve racial equity.
Kristen, are Japanese American activists and community leaders in conversation with African Americans about this process?
I think so. And I think there's been a lot of support for, as Karen is talking about, investigation into, the consequences of these actions that the federal government has taken towards various ethnic groups over the course of its history. So I think, there's a lot of support for further study of this.
Karen, the fact that now we have, an administration which is largely not aligned with these kinds of policies. How does that affect the conversation when it comes to these historic injustices? Do you see it that it accelerates the need for these kinds of reparations and gestures, or that it sort of stifles it?
Well, we need to accelerate it. No matter the hurdles that have to be crossed, we can't stop. We can't give up hope. My father said, to stand up for what is right. And we need to keep pursuing, this call for social justice, because, that's what we need to do to make change in this country.
And your father, he refused to go to the internment camps. He was subsequently arrested, then found himself in the center of this infamous Supreme Court case, which ultimately found it was legal to hold Japanese Americans in internment camps. Many years later, quite recently, Chief Justice Roberts had something to say about that. What did his statement mean to you, and how relevant do you think it was for this conversation?
Well, my honest opinion is it was as basically a throwaway. I mean, it was to us a retaliation of Justice Sotomayor's scathing dissent in Trump versus Hawaii. It's an amicus brief that I submitted my name to show the dangers of the overreaching of power, and that to remind the courts of the mistakes in the past. All Justice Roberts did was uphold the Muslim travel ban, marginalized another ethnicity, and dishonored my father all in one breath.
Kristen, do you think this resolution could be a model for other states?
Oh, sure. Well, I mean, I think it's a very welcomed gesture, albeit overdue, long overdue. But I think it brings attention to the past injustices that, the California legislature was implicit in supporting. And so I think it does make an important statement, especially today, for the California legislature to say that this was wrong, the forced removal and the subsequent incarceration of Japanese Americans during World War II, and this should not ever happen again to any other group, I think is making a very important statement.
Does California owe survivors monetary compensation in addition to this apology?
Well, that would be, certainly the right thing to do. I think it would be a bit of a challenge at this point because, the reparations went to those people that were still living. And to try to make this retroactive would be a big challenge. I would rather have the state to put more money in education. Because now that we have this assembly bill, we hopefully will be passed, How is that going to trickle down to, especially K through 12? Because even when I was growing up, there was nothing in the books about the Japanese American incarceration. And so it's, if we're going to learn from our mistakes, then we need to start teaching these lessons at a very young age.
Dr. Karen Korematsu is the founder and executive director of the Fred T. Korematsu Institute. And Kristen Hayashi is the director of collections management and access and a curator at the Japanese American National Museum. Thank you both so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
This week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, I'll talk with psychologist Jonathan Haidt about his book, The Anxious Generation.
We're overprotecting in one place, and I'm saying, lighten up, let your kids out. And we're underprotecting in another, and I'm saying, don't let your kids spend 9 hours a day on the internet talking with strange men. It's just not a good idea.
Jonathan Haidt on the New Yorker Radio Hour from WNYC Studios. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
On Tuesday, the Boy Scouts of America filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy. In recent years, hundreds of former scouts have filed lawsuits against the organization, alleging that they were sexually abused by scoutmasters and other leaders. The cases span decades.
You're really seeing the decline of scouting over the past several decades for many reasons. And this is just, I hate to say it, almost another nail in the coffin.
That's Scott Leadingham. He's the news director of Northwest Public Broadcasting.
And I've been in Boy Scouts and the scouting program since I was 8 years old. So upward of close to 30 years and been an Eagle Scout for 21 years.
Today, Scott volunteers at a summer camp run by the Boy Scouts. Recently, he's noticed a large drop off in the number of new scouts attending the camp. And while he was initially encouraged by efforts to modernize the Boy Scouts, like allowing transgender members, the sexual assault allegations have made him cynical about the future of the organization.
This didn't happen overnight. This was a systemic issue that happened over the course of decades. And the hubris that led to it is, not that much different than the hubris that led to the same sort of issues happening in the Catholic Church and other large-scale organizations. It's the same sort of thing where you always want to protect the organization and its reputation over the actual people that you are supposed to be serving.
And Scott's concerns about the Boy Scouts are also being felt by many former scouts suing the organization, unsure what the bankruptcy moves for the future of their cases. For more, I'm joined by Gillian Dumas, an attorney at Dumas & Vaughn. She's currently representing clients in roughly 36 cases against the Boy Scouts of America on the West Coast. Welcome, Gillian.
Hi, everyone.
Gillian, is it possible the Boy Scouts will shut down?
The bankruptcy they filed is to reorganize, not shut down. So I don't think so. This is sort of like what all of the Catholic archdioceses and dioceses around the country, many of them filed the same sort of bankruptcy proceedings, and they didn't shut down. So no, I think they're looking for a path forward, but what they're really looking for is a deadline for the sex abuse claims that have been filed against them over the years, really starting in the 80s. The trouble with that is that abuse survivors are on their own timeline, and it takes them decades to come forward. So being all of a sudden put on this fast track of a bankruptcy proceeding, that's going to be hard for survivors.
So the Boy Scouts is in a position to determine when survivors come forward?
The final decision is not going to be up to the Boy Scouts, but simply by putting this into bankruptcy, they're going to ask for a claims bar date, and the court is going to give them one. Whether that's a year from now or 90 days from now or some other period, we don't know yet because it's too early to make that decision, but it's going to be a deadline. So that means that anybody with a claim needs to come forward and bring that claim. And it might be emotionally rough for people, but they're going to have to do it. And that's what's so difficult for so many survivors, because they need to talk to their families. Some of them have never told their wives. They've never told their parents. And they're going to need to, get the emotional wherewithal to do that. And some of them may never do it. And that's pretty unfair.
You traveled to Wilmington, Delaware this week, where the Boy Scouts filed for bankruptcy. Why was it so important for you to be there?
Well, a lot of most of our clients have already filed their lawsuits. And that makes us different than a lot of the attorneys around the country who have signed up a lot of clients with the idea that they would bring their claim in the bankruptcy proceeding. Our clients have already filed their lawsuits. One of our clients was going to start picking a jury in his case this Friday. He filed his case 2 years ago. And so when he heard that the bankruptcy had been filed, he was devastated. It was like the rug got pulled out from under his feet. So we wanted to be here just to know exactly what was going on, see the judge with our own eyes, see the courthouse with our own eyes, know exactly what was going to happen in his case and in the cases of our clients who have already been in the courthouse and have already started their lawsuits. All of those lawsuits are going to be moved now into the bankruptcy case, and that's a big wrench for them. So we wanted to just be here on the ground to be part of it so we could report back to our clients, because they're going to have a lot of questions.
How did your clients react to the bankruptcy news?
It was a mixed reaction. Those like our guy who is starting his trial essentially this week with picking the jury, he, like I said, was the most shocked and the most hurt. He saw it as another betrayal by the Boy Scouts of not stepping up to the plate and taking responsibility. There were some, though, whose cases just got filed, right, like when the California statute of limitations window opened this January. So their cases have only been filed for a few weeks. They're early enough in the litigation process that they're hopeful that transferring their claims into bankruptcy won't be a delay and might even speed things up. And they may be even optimistic that bankruptcy will give them a more efficient way to process their claim that is less stressful than going through full-on litigation in trial court. So it's a little bit of a mixed bag. I think overall, some of them are disappointed. Most of them are disappointed that they won't get the transparency that they want, and they won't get the accountability from the Boy Scouts for actually causing and allowing their sexual abuse to happen, now that the focus is shifting just to what are the Boy Scouts' assets and making this all about financial compensation. It is about financial compensation, but for the survivors, it's about the truth coming out, and it's about the history of Boy Scouts' sexual abuse and not protecting kids. And that's the story that they want to be heard. And sadly, that won't happen in bankruptcy.
Gillian Dumas is an attorney at Dumas and Vaughn. Thanks so much, Gillian.
Thank you.
And you can find the full statement from the Boy Scouts of America regarding their bankruptcy filing online at thetakeaway.org.
My name is Bill from Royersford, Pennsylvania. As both an Eagle Scout and victim of abuse by one of my Scout leaders, I believe that this had to happen. Overall, I feel as though Scouting is a very good program. This Chapter 11 bankruptcy hopefully will allow the Boy Scouts to correct what was wrong and continue to run high-quality programs. I personally hold no ill feelings towards the Boy Scouts of America.
This is Rob calling from Lansdowne, Pennsylvania, and I am indeed a former Boy Scout, and hopefully this not only leads to the permanent demise, but also sends a message to all organizations that do something wrong and know about it and then try to cover it up, that they'll be next for extinction. No amount of good any organization does is worth a lifetime of misery for an innocent life.
My name is Aubrey Philibert from Scarsdale, New York. I'm a former Boy Scout back in second grade. Though I've never faced instances of abuse, knowing how pervasive it was is upsetting. And with this bankruptcy filing, I see it as an end to this horrible chapter, one where an ending was needed. And I look forward to a Boy Scouts of America that I can send my child to safely.
That's our show for today. Remember, you can always call us about anything at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Arun Vandigopal, in for Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.